So we're hopefully guaranteed. Now, sometimes I forget to look at my notes, which is the other. Okay, so let's begin. So I'm planning to take really like the first 15 minutes. I said that we had only 2 minutes left on the neutrino standard model, but there are a couple of things I really should say a little bit more about, so or else they'll be completely confusing. I'll spend the first part of the lecture on that, and then we'll learn to write down all the vertices and how to write down Feynman diagrams for the standard model. Okay, fine. So finishing the neutrino standard model, let's get back to where we were. So we had written down the Lagrangian for the neutrino standard model, and I'm going to write the whole Lagrangian out here just because then later we'll use the same Lagrangian when we were looking for Feynman diagrams. So I'm going to, even though the bosonic terms are the same as they ever were, I'll write them down anyway. Okay, and for simplicity, I'm going to write the Lagrangian down in the not spontaneously symmetry broken form, again, just for pedagogy later when we work out the Feynman diagrams. Okay, so, and then we have the terms for the Higgs boson, the kinetic term, and the potential terms. And then we have the kinetic terms for the fermions. Now, the only new thing on this line is a kinetic term for the right-handed neutrino. And we have the normal Yukawa couplings to the Higgs boson. I could write faster, but I'm afraid this is my limit. Okay, so again, now we have, compared to the standard model, we have the one new term here, which is the coupling of the left-handed lepton doublet to the Higgs to the right-handed neutrino now, and then plus the Hermitian conjugate of everybody here. And then, if we just had this, there would be a sort of complete parallelism between the quarks and the leptons. We would have, you know, these three quark kinetic terms paralleled by these three lepton kinetic terms, and this quark Yukawa coupled by parallel to this lepton Yukawa, and this quark Yukawa parallel to this lepton Yukawa, and so then if this was our Lagrangian, remember before we had this term, we were able to completely diagonalize by absorbing things. Completely diagonalize the lepton Yukawa matrix and turn that into a real diagonal matrix. Whereas in the quark sector, we were only able to diagonalize this guy. We didn't have enough freedom to also diagonalize this guy, so we had the CKM matrix times the diagonal matrix here. Now, if this was the full Lagrangian, now this part of the story would be unchanged. But now over here, we would have an exactly analogous story. We could, let's say, completely diagonalize this guy and turn that into a real diagonal matrix, or vice versa. Let's say to keep, we're not going to do this, but I'm just trying to explain logically. So we could diagonalize this guy as before, but then we wouldn't have the freedom to also diagonalize this guy. This guy would be a diagonal matrix times a unitary matrix, analogous to the Yukawa matrix, analogous to the CKM matrix here. Okay, but there's an important additional term we can write down. As we saw, there's a fifth line here, which is where the right-handed neutrino, its charge conjugate couples via a mass matrix to the right-handed neutrino itself, plus Hermitian conjugate. Okay, so things are different. Oh, sorry, and this is, again, this is capital, this mass matrix I refer to as capital M sub little m. Okay, so in the nothing has changed for the quarks, so that we can diagonalize them to exactly the same, we can absorb parameters exactly the same as before. So really we'll replace this capital Y by a little diagonal Y, and we'll replace this capital Y sub D by VCKM times little Y sub D. Now the conventional, now what about the lepton sector? What's the most we can do? Well, the most we can do, I won't do the analysis explicitly on the board, but it's an argument very analogous to the one we did before. You can try. It turns out this has to be, this term is symmetric actually, because this is new right appearing here. Well, secretly, this is actually basically new right transpose appearing here, because we took new right dagger to get the bar, but then we also took another complex conjugate to get the C. So actually, this is new right contracted with new right transpose. So we have the same two fields appearing in a quadratic form. So actually, this can always be taken to be symmetric. So this is a symmetric matrix. We can diagonalize this guy with the same unitary on each side. Whereas, so you know that here we get a U and U dagger when we diagonalize, or orthogonal matrix, I should say, on both sides. It's a symmetric matrix, so it can be a Hermitian matrix can be diagonalized by unitaries. A symmetric matrix can be diagonalized by orthogonals. Whereas these guys are so far arbitrary matrices, so when we do the singular value decomposition, you know, this can be written as a diagonal matrix sandwiched between two different unitaries, U and V. And that was the whole trouble with absorbing everything. Okay, so if you just go through that same kind of argument, putting two of the same unitaries here and here, but two different unitaries here and here, and two different unitaries here and here, and see how much can you absorb. Well, you can't absorb them all. And the conventional thing, which is the most you can do, is the following. We will diagonalize M and absorb these two unitaries into new right and new right C here, okay? So that completely absorbs those. And so henceforth, I will assume that this capital M is already a diagonal matrix, okay? By doing our field redefinition of new right. But now we have no further freedom to further redefine new right. We've completely absorbed all the freedom to change basis in the new right sector. But that's a diagonal matrix. Okay, what about over here? Well, now we still have the freedom to rotate E right and L left, so we can absorb both the U and the V from this matrix. So once again, we can completely diagonalize this matrix and turn that into a real diagonal matrix here too. So these guys will become, this convention is to work in a basis where these guys are both real diagonal. But then now we have no freedom left over to modify this guy. So this guy is now an arbitrary complex non-diagonal matrix. Okay, so if we look back at our, at what we discussed last time. So last time we had said that if we just looked at the quadratic part of this Lagrangian involving neutrinos and after spontaneous symmetry breaking, the thing which I explained on the board and which partly is left as an exercise for you guys, is that that part of the Lagrangian becomes, we can write it as 1 half times this capital nu bar times partial slash. The list chunk isn't working well. Times nu bar minus 1 half capital nu bar times this mass matrix, 0, m nu transpose, sorry, m nu transpose, m sub little m times k capital nu, where I remind you that capital nu is this column of six Majorana fermions, the top three being the Majorana fermions little nu, and the bottom three being the Majorana fermions little nu prime, where little nu are the Majorana fermions constructed from nu left and its charge conjugate, and nu prime are the three Majorana neutrinos constructed from nu right and its charge conjugate. Okay, so then, yes, so something that I did at the end last time that was confusing, which I should clarify now, is the first thing I did here was I block diagonalized this matrix. You see, ultimately the point is just we want to take this 6x6 matrix and diagonalize it. That's always the name of the game when you're trying to separate out whether the physical propagating modes in your theory. And so we could just do that in one step. It just obscures the physics of the diagonalization process. I mean, you could put it into, you can give that matrix to Mathematica and diagonalize it, but the point is to understand what's going on. So in practice, what you need to do, even though it's a little bit confusing, is go in two steps. So the first step is where we block diagonalize this into block diagonal form. So we said that is like 0 m nu transpose. We rewrote this guy as an orthogonal matrix times a block diagonal matrix, where this top guy was like minus m nu m sub m inverse m nu transpose, if I'm not mistaken. Am I mistaken? Yeah, that's right. And then zeros on the off-diagonal blocks, and then this guy was m sub m still. Again, this is, in general, it's hard to analytically diagonalize this matrix, it's easy in the limit where this matrix is way bigger than the eigenvalues of this matrix are huge compared to the eigenvalues of this matrix. In which case, to leading order in the ratio of this to this, this is the answer. Times O transpose. So this is O transpose times O. So we absorb the O's into this new field that I called n hat, was given by O times capital nu. And then we wrote this guy. Okay, this is a column of six Majorana fermions. I wrote the top three now as n, and the bottom three little n and capital N. And so these bottom three guys, they're already seeing a diagonalized mass matrix. They only talk to this part now. So these guys are three heavy Majorana neutrinos with the eigenvalues given by the diagonals of this matrix. This matrix has not yet been diagonalized. So one more step, which I won't do on the board, we'll talk about it though in the next lecture when we talk about mixing of neutrinos, but we won't get to that today. We can just do one more step where we write this bit. Let's call this matrix, I'm running out of terms for these matrices, but let's call the upper block there mu. We can write mu as some other, now 3x3 orthogonal matrix. It's a symmetric matrix, so we can write this as some 3x3 orthogonal matrix O hat times a diagonal matrix, 3x3 matrix M hat times O hat transpose O hat. And then we can define absorb this O hat into a change of basis just in this three-dimensional part. So we can define a new guy, little n hat, which is O hat times the old guy n. And so these are really the, so now in terms of this in terms of this new field, okay, so if I define capital N hat, okay, sorry, slight change of notation. Let me call this guy N prime. So now if I define capital N hat prime to be little n prime, that guy, and capital N, then now this Lagrangian becomes, is fully diagonalized. It's minus, should be I over 2. I over 2 capital N hat prime bar partial capital N hat prime, and then minus 1 half n hat prime bar times a mass matrix, which let's call it m hat prime, times n hat prime. And now this guy is the fully diagonalized mass matrix, which has, this is a 6x6 matrix, which has the same old matrix, diagonal matrix M sub little m on the lower diagonal block. And on the upper diagonal block, it has the diagonalized version of this 3x3 matrix, this one. Okay. And so now these are three heavy neutrinos, Majorana neutrinos, with these three heavy eigenvalues, mass values. And these are the three light neutrino mass eigenstates with these three light neutrino eigenvalues. And again, what I wanted to emphasize is that, so you'll do this, you know, it all gets more complicated than it needs to be because it's diagonalizing a 6x6 matrix. The gist of the whole problem can be done with just a 2x2 case where we ignore the fact that there's three families and just work with as if there was one heavy neutrino and one light neutrino. And in that case, you know, what you find is that if the heavy neutrino has this mass m sub m, then the light neutrino has a mass which basically is like, you know, if you look at this expression, there's two copies of m nu, and there's one copy of the inverse of m, which in one dimension would just be 1 over m. Okay, so this is basically, if the heavy mass is m sub m, the light mass is like m sub nu squared over m sub m. And this is the so-called seesaw mechanism, because if m sub m is much larger than m sub nu, then this eigenvalue is much larger than m sub nu, while this eigenvalue is much smaller than m sub nu, because this is m sub nu times the small ratio m sub nu over m sub m. And so it's called the seesaw, because the more you drive this side up, the more you make this bigger than m sub nu, the more you make this guy smaller than m sub nu. And so the idea is that it's supposed to be an explanation for the three neutrinos that we see, the three light neutrinos that we observe them to have masses which are tiny compared to all of the other neutrinos and all of the other fermions in the standard model, just many orders of magnitude smaller than all of the other fermions in the standard model. Why is that? Well, it's an open mystery, but in this model with an extra new right, with extra new right fields, it's linked to the fact that the new right fields are the only fields in the standard model that don't get their masses from the Higgs. Everybody else doesn't have an explicit mass term. It only gets a mass when the Higgs obtains a non-zero vacuum expectation value. And so everybody else's mass is controlled by the vacuum expectation value of the Higgs. But the right-handed neutrino, the heavy neutrino, is the only guy where you can write down just a completely bare mass term that has in principle nothing to do with the vacuum of expectation value of the Higgs. There's no equation relating them or anything like that. So in principle, this could be a lot bigger than the vacuum expectation value of the Higgs. And if so, it would explain via this mechanism why the light neutrino masses are much smaller than the vacuum expectation value of the Higgs. Yeah.
Why didn't we redefine the heavy neutrinos with the O's? Why did we only do that with the light ones?
Yeah, sorry. So what I was saying before was that if you want, we already did it before we, right at the beginning, when I said we're going to work, we're going to reabsorb, just like we did with the quarks, we're going to reabsorb things right from the start so that this matrix is diagonal and this matrix is diagonal times a unitary. I also do the analogous thing. I'm taking the normal convention is to also, right at the get-go, absorb the orthogonals here into new right and new right C to make this guy diagonal right from the get-go. So these two guys, this matrix and this matrix, are already diagonal before I get to this board. So I don't need to further diagonalize this matrix. If I hadn't begun in that basis, I could at this step do that, but conventionally that's not the basis that people work. Yeah.
Is this mass term used, for example, in cosmology? Say, I don't know, like if the Higgs field has not reached its equilibrium state already, we still have like all the mass would be neutrinos in the universe.
That is true. That's actually absolutely true. That at early times the Higgs is pinned by thermal fluctuations to zero vacuum expectation value, and so the in a sense the other fermions are all massless above those scales, and only the right-handed neutrino has mass yet. And yes, in fact, that is used in cosmology. In fact, that's actually, I'm actually about to say something about that right now that you mention it. Okay, so that's actually the last thing I was going to say, just very briefly. So we'll discuss the answer to that question more in the second half of the course. But for now, I just wanted to say one quick word about that, which is that, so as I had mentioned, okay, so that's the story with what are the basic particles and how do their masses work and how do the mass... Oh, you know what? There's one other thing. Sorry. So one other thing that's worth clarifying here is that... So again, if the seesaw mechanism is the explanation for why the observed neutrinos are so light... compared to all the other fermions in the standard model. That turns out to have other advantages in cosmology, as I'll mention in a second, but let's assume for a second that that's true. Okay, then, again, if we look at this matrix, it was already almost diagonal because it had a block, the only non-zero thing that was big was on the diagonal here, and then the off-diagonal things were very small by comparison. So that means that when we diagonalized in this step, this matrix O was close to the identity matrix. There wasn't much to do in order to make this matrix block diagonal. We didn't have to change much. Okay, so this is a small six-dimensional rotation. So, in other words, when we look at this equation, where we've gone from this basis, where we have nu and nu prime on the top and bottom, to this basis where we have the light neutrinos and the heavy neutrinos separated on the top and bottom, well, there's not much of a difference. Okay, so I know we haven't yet completely diagonalized this part, but the point is all the light neutrinos are going to live up here. We haven't quite diagonalized this three-dimensional space, but we're just going to do some rotation in that space. So these are the light neutrinos, these are the heavy neutrinos. And the point is that in the seesaw limit, those are almost the same as the splitting into nu and nu prime. So in other words, if the seesaw mechanism is correct, the light neutrinos that we observe are almost entirely made of the left-handed, the Majorana neutrino nu, which was made from the left-handed neutrino. These are the neutrinos that do talk to the weak force. They came from a left-handed lepton doublet. Whose kinetic term, you know, which is transforms as a doublet under SU2. So it has a non-zero charge also under U1. So it talks to SU2 times U1. So these are the ones, these are the guys that do feel SU2 times U1. We'll see that more when we write down their vertices later in the lecture. These guys don't. These are completely inert. They don't transform under any of the standard model gauge transformations. So they don't feel any of the standard model, they don't talk to any of the standard model gauge fields. So what I'm trying to say is that if the seesaw mechanism is correct, the light neutrinos that we see at low energies are Majorana neutrinos that are made almost exclusively from the left-handed neutrino and its charge conjugate, whereas the heavy neutrino, with just a small admixture of the right-handed neutrino and its charge conjugate, whereas the heavy neutrinos, it's the opposite. They're made almost exclusively out of the right-handed neutrino and its charge conjugate, which is completely inert, with just a small admixture of the left-handed neutrino and its charge conjugate. Okay.
Just a question about the masses of the neutrino.
Yes.
Given the uncertainty we have, we know that this, I mean, if we know that the neutrinos are lighter than a certain value,
mm-hmm.
what would be the mass of the biggest neutrino? What's the order?
Yeah, so, it depends. You can't say exactly because it depends on it depends on the value of the Yukawa couplings here, it turns out. There end up being two possibilities. These guys are very. There's really two ways. There's two ways to make these guys very light. One way is just to say, let's say, for example, these things might be order one. Maybe these Yukawa couplings are rather big. In which case, M nu, the matrix M nu, is about equal to the Higgs-Vev. And in that case, you end up finding that the corresponding heavy masses, have to be much heavier than the electroweak scale. So these things would be up at something like 10 to the 13 or 10 to the 14 GeV, 10 to the 13 or 10 to the 14 times as heavy as a proton. Very heavy. Okay? But as you make, that's if these Yukawa couplings are as large as possible. Or if they take their most natural values, namely their order unity. But many of the other Yukawa couplings in the standard model are much less than order, much less than one. So it could be that these guys are also much less than one. As you begin to decrease the size of these guys, you end up decreasing the corresponding predicted mass for the heavy neutrinos as well. Without decreasing the size of the light neutrino masses, so in fact, you know, as you bring these guys very far down, if you allow these to be super tiny, for example, in fact, this is even potentially a cosmologically relevant case, as I'll mention in a minute. If you let these guys be very tiny, then you can explain the lightness of the light neutrino masses just due to the tininess of these guys without even having to put the right-handed neutrino masses above the electroweak scale. So there's a huge, huge uncertainty in if you ask, you know, what strictly speaking constraint do we have on the mass of these right-handed neutrinos? At the moment, there's a huge uncertainty on that. Okay, but that's a good bridge to the next thing I was going to say. Last thing I was going to say about neutrinos. And I only have time to say this very briefly at the moment, but again, we'll come back to it in the next part, of course, is that, as I mentioned, you know, an advantage of the neutrino standard model over the previous models we've discussed is that it can also explain it can explain what the dark matter is and what the matter-antimatter asymmetry is. So it can explain dark matter, and it can explain the matter-antimatter asymmetry through a process called leptogenesis. Okay, and so what is the idea? Well, it turns out that if you look at this model and ask, is there a dark matter candidate in it? Well, you can start by saying, is there any particle in this model that we haven't detected yet and can be stable or at least live very long relative to the current age of the universe? And the answer in the previous models we had looked at, standard model and the standard model effective field theory, was no. In this model, there is exactly one particle that can. So if you look at the three heavy neutrinos, one of them can still be stable. Okay? And moreover, if it is stable, it turns out to imply that one of the three light neutrinos has zero mass. Okay, and that's still perfectly compatible with everything we've observed, and in fact, it does seem to be turning out. Observations have been pushing down and down and have not yet detected. Cosmological observations have been pushing down and down and have not yet detected any upper bound on the neutrino masses. I mean, they've only been able to place upper bounds on the neutrino masses. So indeed, the mass of the lightest neutrino has been pushed down already rather close to zero, and that constraint will get better and better. So if, as cosmology experiments push down on measuring the sum of the three light neutrinos, cosmology can measure, it turns out, the sum of the three light neutrinos, the mass of the little n1, n2, and n3. And we know the differences between these masses, but we don't know the overall mass of any of these three neutrinos. But if the lightest guy is zero, and you know the differences between the other two, it means there's a certain minimum value for the sum of their three masses. And if this guy is really the dark matter, the prediction is that the sum of these three neutrinos should have the minimum possible value. So in the coming years, and not very near, in the near future, where I mean maybe within the next 5 or 10 years, cosmology will, unless this model is wrong, detect the sum of these three neutrino masses, even if it has the lowest possible value. And if it detects it to be above the minimum possible value, then that will rule out this last remaining dark matter candidate in this model. It will say this model cannot be the whole story and is ruled out. On the other hand, as I say, at the moment what's been happening is that it's the upper bounds have just been closing in, and it is still compatible with the sum of these three masses being the minimum possible value. So the dark matter would be one of the heavy neutrinos. Leptogenesis, well, very briefly, what is that? The other two guys, it turns out, cannot be stable, compatible with the other things we know about the model. So they decay in the very early universe. What can happen is this process called leptogenesis, which is that you make these guys in the early universe. At very early times, they're in thermal equilibrium with the thermal bath in the early universe. But when the temperature falls below their mass, they no longer can maintain equilibrium. They fall out of equilibrium. And then they're unstable. A little bit later, they decay. Now, when they decay, well, this particle can decay. If you look at the above Lagrangian, and here I'll be explaining, I haven't yet gone through the vertices for the standard model, so you just have to take my word at the moment. But very shortly, you'll be able to figure this out for yourself. This neutrino can decay into the Higgs doublet and the left-handed lepton, but this is a Majorana particle; it's its own antiparticle, so it can also decay into the anti-state here. Okay, the charge conjugate state. So this is, in other words, into the Higgs twiddle and the and this antilepton. So this final state has lepton number 0 plus 1. This guy has lepton number 0 minus 1. So they have two different lepton numbers. Now, if the theory did not violate both C and CP, these two decay rates would have to be equal. But because we just saw above, we can't, just like in the quark sector, we couldn't absorb all of the complex numbers out of the coupling constants in the quark sector, and we were left with one complex phase in the CKM matrix. Here we have considerably more that we can't absorb. This matrix Y sub nu, we absorbed everything we could, but this Yukawa matrix Y sub nu was left over, and it's basically an arbitrary complex 3x3 matrix. So for all we know, and for all we have in terms of constraints on this thing, it can have a hell of a lot of complex, large complex phases in it. And if so, then these two rates, if it has any non-zero complex phases in it, these two rates will in general be non-zero. And if it's not too small, these two rates will be different from each other. And if it's not too small, they'll be significantly different from each other, so that when the heavy neutrinos N2 and N3 decay in the early universe, you'll get an excess of leptons, let's say, over antileptons. So when these guys decay, you get a lepton number asymmetry, where there's more lepton particles than antileptons in the early universe. And then it turns out that at the electroweak phase transition, when the temperature in the early universe drops below when the temperature in the early universe gets low enough for the Higgs field to no longer be pinned here and to fall into the bottom of its potential. Shortly before that time, there's a process called the Sveilleron process in the Standard Model, which converts this sum of this lepton asymmetry, sum of this net lepton number, into net baryon number, which is what we observe in the universe today. We don't really directly observe, we don't directly know what the net lepton number is, but we know the net baryon number is positive. And so this process is still allowed, still seems like a good working bit of physics. And so this process called leptogenesis is, I think most people think the most, at the moment, the most conservative explanation for allowed explanation for what produced the matter-antimatter asymmetry in the universe. Yeah.
But does the decay have an influence on the way the Higgs field goes to the minimum? Is that what you're saying? Or
No, not really. No. They're almost completely decoupled from one another. No. It's just that it turns out. I was just trying to describe I didn't mean to confuse things. The only reason there is a moment in the early universe when the temperature, the early universe is cooling. There's some moment when the temperature is at the electroweak scale, which is roughly the time when this transition happens. Prior to that transition, this Sveilleron process was able to rapidly convert lepton number asymmetry into baryon number asymmetry. After this transition, that Sveilleron process ceased to be efficient. So in the low energy universe, in the cold universe today, this Sveilleron process, although in principle, occurs in principle, at low temperatures it's so suppressed that you don't actually see leptons converting into baryons and vice versa. But above the electroweak temperature, it happens freely. That's what I meant to say. Okay, so that's the basic point. That maybe I'll just say one other thing, which is that it turns out there are this basic idea that one of the heavy neutrinos is the dark matter, and the other two are responsible for leptogenesis. Actually turns out to be able to happen in two different ways. Okay, so for the past, over the past 20 years, or 15 years, Shaposhnikov and collaborators worked out one one route in detail in a great series of papers. I mean, for my money, this is some of the best high energy physics and theoretical cosmology that's been done over the past 15 years. So they showed in detail how this, what at the time was thought was the only path by which this can work, which, and where what happens is that all three of the new lefts are in thermal equilibrium with the thermal bath at early times, and it's due to the fact that they that the new lefts are a tiny admixture of the heavy neutrino. Remember, the new lefts are mostly the three light neutrinos, little n1, little n2, and little n3, but they have a tiny admixture from that block diagonal, from that 6x6 block diagonalization process. They have a tiny admixture of these guys also. So these guys get produced a little bit by the thermal bath in the early universe, just when the new lefts are produced. In order for that sort of process to work, it turns out that the light neutrino, the dark matter, the heavy dark matter neutrino, actually is, well, it's heavier than the light neutrinos, but it's, but compared to anything else, it's not heavy. It turns out to have to be about a kilo electron volt. So this is like 500 times lighter than the electron. That's actually quite light. And then these two guys, N2 and N3, have to be about the same mass, and they both have to be about a GeV. So they're both about as heavy as the proton. Okay, but then the year before last, and my collaborators found, Neil Turek here and my former student Karen Finn found there was another way, completely different way to make this work, which we found as part of the CPT symmetric universe idea. And so here, very briefly, the idea is that, you know, there's a special state in the universe. The fields living in our F4W universe, we realize there's a particular vacuum state, which is preferred, which is the one that not only respects the ordinary symmetries of Friedman-Robertson-Walker universe, but also CPT symmetry. So in that state, it's as if, you know, if this is the Big Bang and then the universe expanding and this is today, it's as if there's a sort of mirror copy of the universe before the Big Bang, and the fields are in the state that is symmetric between these two mirror copies. And it turns out that in that way of doing things, well, if one of the heavy neutrinos is stable, it also emerges from the Big Bang, but not because it's produced by the thermal plasma at early times, but because it actually radiates, if you want, from the Big Bang in exact analogy to how Hawking radiation radiates from the horizon of a black hole. It's a very closely analogous calculation. So it's a quantum effect, not a thermal effect. And in that case, the predicted masses here are very different. So this guy is much heavier, 4.8 times 10 to the, turns out you can calculate very accurately what it is. It's some particular number, which is about a billion times as heavy as the proton. And then these other guys, N2 and N3, well, unfortunately, you can't say exactly what they are in this scheme, but they're much heavier than this. So these guys are up at around 10 to the 13 or 10 to the 14 GeV. Okay, but so anyway, just to say, this model can still do these two things. There's two routes to do it. That's all I was going to say about that. I went longer on this than I had intended to. Okay, but still, it's important to pause for the break, which I had forgotten to do before. First, are there any questions about anything? I should also say, have I been leaving someone high and dry who has some great thing to tell us or perform for us or dance for us, or everybody's avoiding my eyes? Okay, good. I have something. I finally wrote my limerick. Here we go. There was a young kid from Perimeter who refused to let fear of heights limit her. While skydiving one day, she, alas, passed away when she failed to recharge her altimeter. which is like the gauge that tells you how high you are. The idea was that her altimeter was like an app on her iPhone, and she just forgot to recharge it, and then she pulled out her iPhone while falling and didn't know how high she was. Okay, so it didn't go over that great. I thought it would be fun to get maybe as a, hopefully an inducement to some of you. I wrote the beginnings of a couple other limericks, which I encourage you to finish, okay? So I consider these beginnings, let's say, juicy, but I withheld. I said, I'm not gonna do these myself. I'm giving them as a gift, you understand? So this one begins, an honest perimeter youth. Was famous for telling the truth. Okay, that's one possible beginning. I think that's quite a strong one. Then I also had a daring perimeter student. Disdained what was cautious and prudent. Also very solid, I would say. I think you can go, it's clear you can go a lot of ways with this. Finally, maybe more controversially, I mean, controversial as to whether it's a solid beginning, but I thought it had potential. Maybe I'll just say this one. This one is a friendly young nerd at perimeter. A friendly young nerd at perimeter would wave to all fish that would swim at her. I was having trouble rhyming with perimeter, as you can tell. In mine, I rhymed it with who refused to let fear of heights limit her. But my other option was, would wave at all fish that would swim at her. Could be something about, you know, well, again, okay. Let's move on to discuss how to calculate Feynman diagram in the standard model. Okay, great. So we've spent all this time learning what the Lagrangians of the standard model and the sort of minimal extensions thereof are, and learning what the particles are in them. And now we want to apply it and figure out, you know, okay, well, what processes are possible in the universe? Ultimately, the standard model is just some very condensed formula that allows you ultimately to predict, you know, which processes are possible and which ones are not, and the possible ones, what is the probability or rate at which they're expected to happen. So, as you know, we answer that quantum mechanically using Feynman diagrams. So we want to know, what are the Feynman diagrams we can write down in the standard model? Well, you know, we need to, Feynman diagrams are just lines connected with vertices, and we need to know what are the possible lines we can write down, and what expression do they stand for, and then what are the vertices we can use to connect them up, and what expressions do they stand for? Okay, so let's talk about the lines first. So that we just read off from the quadratic part of the Lagrangian. So those are the Feynman propagators. Okay, so what did we have? Well, we spent a lot of time deciding that the particles in the standard model after spontaneous symmetry breaking. I should say, you know, when we do Feynman diagrams, we're doing perturbation theory around the vacuum. And so we're generally speaking, you know, at an experiment like the LHC or something, the things moving, when we're calculating Feynman diagrams, we want to be calculating with the fields that represent perturbations around the vacuum. So we want to work with the Lagrangian after after spontaneous symmetry breaking, after we've plugged in little h is equal to 1 over root 2v plus capital H. Okay, so what have we got? Well, we said there's one scalar particle. Okay, we'll write it with just a plain solid line. So that's the Higgs particle, and so it has the normal propagator for a scalar particle, which is b squared minus its mass squared plus I epsilon, where we had derived that mh squared was 2 times the parameter m squared appearing in the Lagrangian. Okay, so that's the scalar. So what about the vector fields? Well, again, we said that there end up being, after spontaneous symmetry breaking, there are 8 gluon fields, g mu a, where a runs from 1 to 8, because there are 8 generators of the Lie algebra SU3. And then there's one other massless vector field, which is the photon, gamma, aka a mu. Gamma mu, I should say. And then there were three massive vector particles, which I'll write just to distinguish them with a dotted line. So there's the z-naught, z-naught, which is a massive vector field with a mass whose expression we calculated. And then there's the w plus and minus. Okay, and for this guy, I will write an arrow on the line to tell you the direction the charge is flowing. So this line can be interpreted in two ways whenever it appears in a Feynman diagram. I can either interpret it as a W plus moving this way or as a W minus moving this way. Okay, and so these guys all have the same kind of propagator. A massive vector field has a propagator that looks like, so let's say G mu comes in polarized in the mu direction over here and comes out in the new polarization over here. And same for all of these, come in polarized in the mu direction and go out polarized in the new direction. Then the propagator is the metric, g mu nu, or eta mu nu, over same sort of thing, p squared minus m squared plus I epsilon. And that's, you may have learned that there's some gauge freedom in this expression. This is in the so-called Feynman gauge, the one Feynman made famous, where this expression is the simplest. Okay, and so in practice, again, these guys are massless. These two guys, we derived explicit expressions for their masses in terms of the parameters in the Lagrangian. I won't repeat those, but I'll just tell you that, so this guy, you know, M Higgs, how big is it actually? We've now measured it. It's about 125 GeV, so that's about 125 times as heavy as the proton. Here, the Z boson mass is about 91 GeV. 91 times as heavy as the proton, and the W boson mass is about 80 GeV. Okay, and so then the only thing left are the fermions. Now fermion, again, we denote by a solid line with an arrow. So this can either be read as the fermion F moving in this direction, or as the corresponding antiparticle F bar moving in that direction. And its propagator is 1 over p slash minus its mass plus I epsilon. And we said that the fermions in the standard model were, well, after spontaneous symmetry breaking, there were 3 down-type Dirac fermions. The down, strange, and bottom quarks, the 3 families. And so these guys have masses which are, it's just good to have a look at these for a second, are respectively 5, 95, and 4200 MeV. So this is a million electron volts. So this is 1/1000th of the mass of a proton. So this guy is getting up to 4.2 GeV. So this guy is four times as heavy as the proton, but these are both much lighter than the proton. There are the up particles, up charm and top. These guys have masses which are 2, 1275, and 170,000 MeV. Okay, and then there's the electron type Dirac neutrinos, which come in three families, electron, mu, and tau. And so these guys have masses of 0.5, 105, and 1800 MeV. And then the neutrinos, the light neutrinos, so these are the masses of the N1, N2, and N3. As we said, we know some mass differences between these guys. We don't actually know their masses, but we know their masses are all less than an EV. Okay, so this EV is 1/1 millionth of this guy, which is 1/1000th of this guy. So these guys have much, much tinier masses. And so, yeah, I mean, it's just good to get a quick understanding. So this guy at 170 GeV is actually the heaviest particle in the standard model, elementary particle. And then the Higgs boson comes next, and then these guys. Okay, those guys are all up at roughly 100 GeV. So they're all comparable to the size of the vacuum expectation value of the Higgs, which turns out to be 240 GeV, but anyway. Whereas the other fermions range over a huge range, and really the short story is no one has a clue about why or where any of these numbers come from. Okay. Fine, so vertices, I'll just say a few things about it and then we'll polish it off next time. But you know, the bottom line is that we have our Lagrangian here, and we've spent most of the course figuring out what the quadratic part of the Lagrangian is, but let me call this line 1, line 2, line 3, line 4, and well, we won't need it, but line 5. Okay, and now all we have to do is do the same thing where we plug in for little h V plus capital H, and now look at all of the terms that are not quadratic, that involve two or that involve three or more fields, and for every term like that, we write down that term. For every field that appears in that term, we get a leg in a Feynman vertex in a Feynman diagram, and the coefficient of that of those fields in the Lagrangian is exactly the coefficient I times that is exactly the factor you write down for that vertex in the Feynman diagram. So let's just do as a quick example, you know, so suppose, for example, let's look at the second line, for example. What'll we get? Well, so you know, when we plug in H plus V plus H, well, and expand out, well, we'll get some zeroth order, first order, and second order terms from here, but nothing higher. But from here, we'll get zero, first, second, and then also cubic and quartic terms in H. Okay, so from line 2 here, we'll get terms proportional to H, we'll get a term proportional to H cubed. And so we'll get a vertex here whose three external legs are all H's. And if we just read off the coefficient of that vertex, of that, if we just remove the H's from that expression and read the coefficient, that would be the vertex factor. That times I would be the vertex factor we would write down here. Okay, we'll also get a quartic coupling here. So we'll also get a term like that involves capital H to the fourth, and so we'll get a vertex that has four H's. Um, And again, the coefficient, which will now here you can see what it is, it'll just be minus lambda over 4 times I will be the coefficient here, and then sometimes there's a whole story about counting the number of independent ways to do it, but that's beyond the level of detail we want to talk about right now. Okay, but so you get so that illustrates the picture. Let's try to see if we can quickly go through and sketch what vertices will come out in the standard model. So let's ask what would come from line one. Well, maybe I'll just do line one, and then I'll. Now you know I've made a resolution about this, haven't I? I'm always tempted to violate my resolution. Okay, I'll cut off here, and by God, we'll finish it all next time anyway. Okay, that's it. Any questions? I faced my temptations and defeated them right in front of you. It was inspiring.
Congratulations.
Thank you.